Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson. Now, all I need is just a little luck.
What kind of luck?
The kind of luck that every girl singer with a band dreams of.
One night a talent scout from a big record company will come in, and he'll let me make a record.
Yes, and then?
And then the guys on Film Spotting will notice me, and...
Oh no, that dream isn't big enough, Josh. Remind me to work on my James Mason for the new year.
That was not too good.
Alas, that dream is all we've got to offer our top five film spotting discoveries this week. Actors and directors who have come to our attention the past year. Plus our review of Spike Lee's Old Boy. That and more.
I'm going to be a star.
Ahead on Film Spotting.
This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over a million high-quality video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. For 25% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code FILM1213.
We're also brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. For our listeners, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service, and one audiobook we can't recommend personally, but it's one I'm definitely interested in seeking out at some point. It is the book 12 Years a Slave, the true story that inspired the Steve McQueen movie, one of the most acclaimed films of the year. It is the book by Solomon Northup, the main character played by Chiwetel Ejiofor in the movie. And this version of the audiobook is narrated by a really fine actor, Louis Gossett Jr.
For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting. That's audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting.
You're listening to Film Spotting. The last time we dedicated a top five to our favorite up-and-coming actors, Old Boy star Elizabeth Olsen made both of our lists. She was coming off her great performance in 2011's Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene. We'll name a new batch of potential future stars later in the show.
But first, what's one way to make both Film Spotting hosts look foolish? Well, after they've named you an up-and-coming actor worth watching, decide to star in something like Old Boy.
Ouch.
Hello? Hello? Hey, tell me why I'm in here. Look at me. No, 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 no.
Get that heart rate. The body of Donna Hawthorne was discovered. The prime suspect... Joseph Doucette, the victim's former husband and father of the surviving child.
Your father's been missing for 20 years. If I could somehow bring him here, do you think you could forgive him?
I could try.
When the Film Spotting poll recently asked listeners what interested them the most about Old Boy, Spike Lee's remake of the 2005 Park Chan-wook cult film, 41% said they weren't interested at all.
So we should just shut the mics off, basically.
Well, you and I were interested, so let's plow ahead anyway, and let's instead talk about some of the other poll results. 13% of listeners said they were interested in the story, which follows Josh Brolin as this jerk of a businessman who ends up being imprisoned for 20 years for reasons he doesn't quite understand, and then he's inexplicably released for reasons he also doesn't quite understand. 20% of listeners wanted to see Old Boy because of the cast. Brolin, also Elizabeth Olsen, she plays a healthcare worker that he runs into and begins to help him investigate what happened to him. Others in the cast include Samuel Jackson and Charlton Copley. But in second place in our poll were votes for Spike Lee as director. That got 26% of the vote. And among those who picked Lee was Curtis G. Schmidt. He said the original Old Boy is a dissatisfying combination of melodrama and boring. If it didn't dip its toes in sexual taboo, it wouldn't have made any splash at all. I'm interested to see if Spike Lee can make something exciting out of the same ingredients.
I think you could have picked a better pseudonym than Curtis G. Schmidt, Josh. I'm not buying that for a second. It sounds made up.
Those aren't my reasons for disliking the original Old Boy, but maybe we'll get to that. We also heard from Ben H., who hails from Austin, Texas. He said, I feel the need to stick up for this film wherever it's mentioned, since so many people seem down on it. While I'm definitely a big fan of Park Chan-wook's original, I couldn't be more excited for Spike Lee's interpretation, which is why I chose him in the poll. I think people have unfairly dismissed this film before it's even come out, mainly because they are comparing Spike Lee the person to Spike Lee the director. One look at 25th Hour or Do the Right Thing, and you know Lee has the audacious visual style to match the modern Korean auteurs. I would definitely agree with that, Ben. Just because Lee is a controversial figure doesn't make him any less powerful behind the camera. Plus, this film is a remake of the manga Old Boy, not the original film, which diverted from the source material a great deal. It's a new take and not some cheap shot-for-shot remake. So come on, guys, stop letting your prejudice against Spike Lee and your instant fear of remakes cloud your judgment. This is a film with a great story being retold by some of the best storytellers in the business. I'm betting this will be another Lee masterpiece that blows all the naysayers out of the water. Now, Ben was writing this in anticipation of Old Boy, but we've both seen it by now.
We have,
obviously.
And let's be clear on one thing. When he said, come on, guys, get over your dislike for Spike Lee and your love for the remake, he's talking to the other commenters in the poll, not us.
Because we both voted. Spike Lee was the reason we were interested.
Exactly.
So, yeah, good distinction there. But that being said, Spike Lee fans that we are, would you, Adam, consider this to be a Spike Lee masterpiece, or are you a naysayer who, according to Ben, deserves to be blown out of the water?
Well, I do love Ben's optimism, because let's be clear again, he hasn't seen the movie yet, and I appreciate his love for Spike Lee. We are both fans as well, but unfortunately, Ben, see the movie and come back to us and tell us what you really thought of it, because it's not anywhere close to a masterpiece for Spike Lee or any other filmmaker. And I do want to get to the style question that he brought up and how it compares to other Korean auteurs in a second. But I do want to focus on Spike to start here, Josh, because I think this ultimately gets at what didn't work about this film for me. The big question I remember us and others asking when we heard that this remake was happening, appropriately for the movie, because it's the key word and the key question at the core of the entire film, is why. We wondered why Spike Lee would be drawn to this material, this subject matter. It just didn't seem to fit. And it finally hit me. I don't know if it hit you, but it hit me in the last 30 minutes or so of the film when I saw the first old, rich, white guy on screen. I realized that even though I joke about that, it's not really about race at all, of course. It's about power. And Spike Lee has always been interested in how the powerful oppress the powerless, and been interested in systems of power and oppression, whether you're talking about mainstream America or the government or the media. You can look at that play out in almost all of his films, if not all of them. And I look to one of his more recent films, Inside Man. That's one where I've talked about before how that movie's all about power. Everything Jodie Foster and her side represents, the bank robbers are striking back at that power. And Denzel Washington's detective is even caught in the middle and is fighting for his own stake within the politics of the police department. Every scene in that movie, I've said multiple times, is kind of its own mini transaction with people exerting their leverage over another person or trying to negotiate some sort of arrangement or make a deal. And you watch Old Boy and you realize it's exactly the same. It's one large transaction, of course, once you get into the real details of the plot, but you also get those kind of interpersonal back and forths and that leverage and people trying to size each other up and get ultimately what's in their best interest. So I did finally understand why he might be attracted to the material. The problem is, he doesn't use that material to say anything interesting about power or systems of power, and it doesn't entertain either. It's just all kind of a grotesque story device. And I remember in the original not feeling so much sympathy, I guess, for the puppet master, the character, the bad guy, if you will, who imprisons him, who's played by Charlton Copley. I didn't really feel sympathy for him, but I did kind of have a begrudging respect for him. His plan, without spoiling anything, all was so perfect and in its own sick way justified. But Josh, by the end of this film, all of it and all that stuff involving power and all the shady dealings going on behind the scenes, it all felt so flimsy to me and made all the more ridiculous by Copley's absurd performance.
Oh, we're going to get to Copley. But yeah, if power is what attracted Lee to this story, that's completely overwhelmed, and he is overwhelmed. The picture is overwhelmed by the sheer ludicrousness of this narrative. And I have to say, true, I did not like the original, but never once while watching that film, which I struggled with a great deal about how I was going to come down on it, never once did I feel that its story was ludicrous or being overwhelmed by it. Whereas here, at every turn, I kept saying to myself, oh, come on. And eventually, it got to the point where it crossed over to camp for me. It became, and I don't like having this reaction to films. It's sometimes an easy one you can take where you just check out of it and start laughing.
Did you feel that way before Copley showed up on screen?
I did. You know where it hit for me? I was okay while Brolin's character was imprisoned. I thought that was fairly effective. And there are actually a few idiosyncratic touches there.
Agreed.
Where you could trace back to Lee. There's this picture of a bellhop, a grinning bellhop on the
wall. I love how he's in like every frame.
and eventually he materializes in a really creepy yet funny way. And so I was with the movie till then. I started to check out about the time Samuel Jackson showed up.
Yeah.
Partly it was due to his look. I mean, he's got this, he's bald except for this ridiculous
that,
blonde,
like, neon
tuft.
Yellow thing or whatever.
The facial hair in general here is like something out of a Hunger Games movie. And I didn't quite, and the original film has stylish touches in terms of fashion as well, but for some reason it was of a piece there. And here they seem like odd choices. Then you get the way the characters are played. Samuel Jackson, when he's being tortured, seems mildly annoyed. And I didn't quite understand what they were going for there. And the things just piled up. The Elizabeth Olsen character, again, comparing it to a movie I did not like, but a thing that didn't bother me about it, the female supporting character in the original Old Boy struck me as, well, this is odd how she's suddenly, you know, following this guy, but never to the degree where I couldn't believe it at all. I mean, Elizabeth Olsen's character is almost raped for hanging around with the Josh Brolin character. And her response to that is, oh, I'm so glad you're still here. And she keeps trotting along after him. That just became ludicrous
to me. And
that
seems horrible.
It's a terrible scene. It's terrible. And it doesn't work in terms of the narrative at all. And this just piled up and piled up until we get Copley.
Hello. I thought it was time we met.
And my goodness, what was he going for here? I mean, I've seen a lot of comparisons, and this came to my mind too, of a Bond villain, right? But this was like a Bond villain who was being directed by Corky St. Clair. I could not understand what I was seeing or how they decided to pursue this way.
Right.
He has a style that's bizarre too, with facial hair and that. He's so exaggerated in his hand gestures. It's like he's telling people where to arrange the furniture instead of giving death threats. And it's inconceivable to me what that was meant to do for this film.
Yeah, I'm totally with you. Definitely on Copley. And overall on this film, though, I did see your star rating of the film on Letterboxd, and I think I enjoyed it a little bit more than you did, not enough to recommend it. What I did learn watching this movie, though, is I would have agreed with you, and I would have agreed with Ben before seeing it, that Spike Lee is one of those audacious visual filmmakers and is someone who would match the style of a Korean auteur like Park Chan-wook or some of the other filmmakers we've seen in our Korean auteurs marathon. But I think to get back to your point about why the ludicrousness doesn't work here and it does work in the original, it's because of the style. It's because you have a guy like Park Chan-wook who can pull it off and make it just the right bit of cartoonish to match the absurdity of everything that's playing out in the story and some of the actions we're seeing. That is never matched here in this film. Spike is one of those guys who has some of those signature touches, the treadmill sequence, if you will, where the camera is attached to the character's head, is looking right at them as they're moving along through a space. We do get a little bit of that here.
Which works well when Brolin is really drunk.
I mean, it works.
Effective.
Yeah, there's another shot similarly behind him when he's on a drunken binge. There are also a lot of overhead shots in that sequence that I don't know if I can pinpoint back to Lee in particular, but I liked what they were going for. I liked the mood it set. I've always also regarded his use of color. I mean, I can just think of certain frames from a lot of different Spike Lee films that always stand out in my mind because of his use of color. So I've always thought of him as a real visual filmmaker. And then I see a movie like this, and despite those touches here or there, I realize that at least what he's doing here, he's not coming anywhere close to matching, as I said, what we get in the original Old Boy. So then when you have things like Copley's facial hair and performance and Samuel L. Jackson's facial hair and performance, even though it's not nearly as over the top and crazy as Copley's, it doesn't fit in this movie because the style of the rest of the film doesn't match it at all. And the elevator sequence is another key example of this. That's the famous sequence that I guess for a lot of people may be your litmus test of whether or not Old Boy works. I don't know how you felt about it. I loved it at the time, not because I really, really enjoy watching a lot of graphic violence, but because it fit in with that film. It seemed just the perfect amount of stylized and cartoon to make me sort of sit back and enjoy what was going on as opposed to really get caught up in the gore or the graphic nature of it. And here we get Spike Lee's version of that sequence, and it's so clumsy and just so clumsily and awkwardly staged that I actually didn't really buy in a lot of instances that they were even touching each other, much less punching each other or killing anyone. So that sequence just completely fell flat. And what happens then throughout the whole film is when we do get moments of intense graphic violence, like when Samuel L. Jackson is being tortured, it really just becomes repellent.
You know what it was for me? In the Hammer scene, it felt dutiful. It felt like the filmmakers knew they had to do this scene, and they had to do it in a slightly different way. So they're paying homage, but also adding their own touch to it.
Right.
And there was no sense of aesthetic conviction behind it. And say what you want about the original Old Boy, but it was behind its violence 100%. Right. That's tied to part of my problem with the film is that, in a nutshell, I felt like it wanted us to think that revenge was not necessarily good while also thrilling on the geek excitement of revenge. Now, I don't know if this makes this Old Boy worse than the original Old Boy to me, but it certainly doesn't make it better the fact that I don't feel that the filmmakers here really believed in these extreme scenes they're doing. They're almost doing them out of sense of duty, and that just doesn't make them work at any level.
No, I'm with you. You're listening to Film Spotting. We're discussing the film Old Boy. It's the new film from Spike Lee, but it's a remake of a 2005 film from South Korea. I felt like as well, all the characters, not just Elizabeth Olsen's character, but Copley when he's introduced, Samuel L. Jackson, even the character played by Michael Imperioli, who's a friend named Chucky. He is a guy that goes back to high school days with Josh Brolin's character. Every single supporting person in this film just served exactly what the plot needed them to do, and otherwise on their own was not interesting at all.
Everything was being formed by that master plan you alluded to, which showed its gaping holes in this film, and again, that didn't in the original. The master plan somehow seemed organic, if that makes sense.
Right.
And here, yeah, you're right. They're just there to serve that next plot point in the story.
And the other thing, I don't know if this stood out to you or you had any kind of strong reaction to it, but I didn't really understand the touches that I suppose seemed like Spike Lee touches, but really added nothing to the story whatsoever. And those were the interjections of real world news footage into the imprisonment sequence, where I understand that Spike is trying to show us the passage of time by showing us Bill Clinton being inaugurated, Barack Obama being inaugurated.
Wasn't that in the original, though?
It might have been.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's been 8 years since I've seen that movie, and I didn't go back and revisit it for this review. But when you see those elements, and especially when you see him cut from events like that, which I'm not saying Barack Obama being inaugurated or Bill Clinton being inaugurated aren't big moments in American history, but, well, we have that happen every 4 or 8 years. It's the bigger things like Katrina and 9/11 footage. And maybe it's just because that footage in particular is so potent. It did make me wonder what he was getting at there, if anything. Why even interject some of those really loaded sequences like that when they really don't bring anything additional to the story that I could find?
No, they didn't add anything that I detected. They just seemed to serve as time markers the way they did in the original.
I do want to go into spoiler territory a little bit here, Josh, and I think we can do that for anyone who hasn't seen this Spike Lee version of Old Boy or the original and doesn't want to listen to this. Obviously, you can fast forward and go to the next segment. But the screenplay here from Mark Protosevich, I'm not sure how you say his name, Protosevich, as you noted with the visuals, it seemed like there were instances where they certainly tried to separate themselves from the original Old Boy and put their own kind of signature on certain things. We get that as well in the screenplay with the ending and the big reveal and the big plot that the Adrian Price character has been working on for 20 years. They changed the ending to, instead of being a brother-sister incestuous relationship, to a father-daughter, well, really father-entire family, it seems like, at least father-daughter-son, incestuous relationship. And I do get the basic impulse to maybe try to do something different, to separate it. I also even get the desire perhaps to maybe raise the stakes a little bit by perhaps thinking they were making it more of a one-to-one relationship. Obviously, if the Joe character, if the Josh Brolin character is going to sleep with his daughter, it makes sense that that's mirroring what the father did mm-hmm. with his daughter from before. But honestly, watching it, all it did for me is add distance between Joe's scenario and Price's scenario. So when the time comes that he has his horribly delivered line where he says something about, I've been waiting 20 years for this moment for you to lose what I lost, it rings completely hollow. It actually doesn't really make any sense at all. And again, that's where this whole grotesque family thing plays out. It really isn't interesting at all. But that distinction, that change they make actually really does weaken the impact. And maybe it was weakened anyway because I know what's coming. I know how the plot is going to play out. I know what the secret is from seeing the original. But really, in this specific case, I really felt like the ending was so weakened by that one change.
Well, maybe we should say, as Ben H. suggested, that's how the original manga did end. I don't know.
I don't know
maybe
either.
That's where they got it, but it certainly does not work. Now, I had been so checked out and had already been experiencing this movie as camp at that point that as horrible and perverse of a reveal as that was, it was almost comedic to me, and also the flashbacks of how they presented it were just so oddly handled as if they were playing them for punchlines.
Really?
And then you add on top of that Copley's cackle. I mean, he literally cackles, and Brolin, who's I think just not the right actor for this part, his howl here is it's not very good.
Yeah.
I mean, Brolin is kind of a strong, silent presence on screen, and is think of him in No Country for Old Men, how well that works. You need someone who has the manic energy of Choi Min-sik from the original. I mean, that was just a good matching of demeanor and character that we don't get here.
Yeah, though it didn't really bother me, I'll admit, because I like Josh Brolin overall as an actor, but I kind of like what he brought to the role in terms of being this more brutish force and seeming like a guy. And I know he's dealing with some of these issues in his personal life, so I'm hoping that's not influencing me too much, but he seems like one of those guys who does really well at playing these sort of blustery big characters who just can't seem to get out of their way and who always seem to be battling.
That's in the beginning, which works.
Yeah.
I completely agree. The beginning works. Once he gets out,
yeah,
it's over.
Well, the end, again, it just no longer works. There was that beautiful, gross symmetry, really sick symmetry to what we had before that made it powerful. And now you've got two characters who their crimes are no longer the same crime, if you want to call it a crime. What they do no longer is the same or close enough to being the same, and it really does, as I said, lessen the impact of that ending, which is a big factor in, I think, what makes the original Old Boy such an interesting film, at least for me and many others, Josh. That's Old Boy, Spike Lee's remake. It's out now in wide release. If you get a chance to see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net. We definitely want to hear from you, Ben H. in Austin, Texas. You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter @filmspotting and at facebook.com/filmspotting.
Massacre Theater's up next with a bit of a soliloquy, although one of us is going to get a pretty good punchline in at the end. And we stretch the definition of a film spotting poll deathmatch by listing four actors and forcing you to choose which one, only one, can continue making movies. Isn't that kind of just a regular poll?
Maybe.
Either way, stay with us.
Hey, everybody, we just wanted to jump in for a minute to remind you that this podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting.
We're also brought to you by Shutterstock, where you'll find the perfect video for your next creative project. Whether it's for your website, advertisement, multimedia presentation, or any other type of film project, you can choose from over a million high-quality stock video clips. There are also 2D animations and 3D motion graphics. Shutterstock sources their video clips from around the world, puts them at your fingertips. Many contributors to Shutterstock are professional filmmakers. Shutterstock reviews each video individually for content and quality before adding it to its library, and they do add about 12,000 video clips each week. That way, every time you visit, you're going to find something new.
And if you do find something you want to download, they have flexible pricing. You can choose between individual clips or video packs or HD or standard definition or web formats as well. You can try Shutterstock today by signing up for a free account. No credit card is needed. Just start an account and begin using Shutterstock to help imagine what your next project could be like and save your video selections you find to your clip box. Once you decide to purchase, use offer code FILM1213. That's FILM1213, and new accounts will receive 25% off any package. Again, Shutterstock.com, and for 25% off, use offer code FILM1213. We do thank Shutterstock for their support. Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. I almost always love our poll questions here on the show, but Josh, I really like this one. Can't wait to get the results from our listeners, but also from you, as we are trying out a new four-way death match.
It's going to get bloody.
Yeah, it is going to get bloody, especially when you consider the film we're discussing. It is the upcoming movie Out of the Furnace. We'll get to that death match poll in a bit. But first, it's time for Massacre Theater.
We perform a scene, you get a chance at winning a prize. Last time, Adam and I massacred this scene.
Bill, I can't get a day's work done for all the good citizens coming in here to harass me about crime in the points. Some even go so far as to accuse Tammany of connivance in this so-called rampant criminality. What am I to do? I can't have this. Something has to be done.
What do you have in mind?
I don't know. I think maybe we should hang someone.
Who?
No one important necessarily. Average men will do. Back alley amusers with no affiliations.
How many?
Three or four.
Which?
Four.
That was Jim Broadbent as Boss Tweed and Daniel Day-Lewis as Bill the Butcher Cutting in Gangs of New York from 2002. It was written by Jay Cox, Steve Zalian, and Kenneth Lonergan, and directed, of course, by Martin Scorsese.
John Potter, right here in Bucktown, Chicago, says Gangs, of course, has a place in its title, like your top five, and like this past week's review, Nebraska. But like Nebraska, Gangs also centers on father-son relationships, with Leonardo DiCaprio's Amsterdam seeking both revenge from and solace in the father figure of Daniel Day-Lewis's Bill the Butcher. What's more, Gangs was co-written by Kenneth Lonergan, whose directorial efforts have earned him some comparisons to Nebraska director Alexander Payne. I'm afraid to say, John, we were just going with the place in its title, but well done.
Peter Craig from Alexandria, Virginia, offers us a little bit of history here. Also, a bit of a stretch, he says, Gangs takes place in the 1860s, specifically 1863, and Nebraska, the featured film this week, became a state in the 1860s, specifically 1867. Do you think Pete knew that just offhand?
I love our learned listeners. Ryan Best here in Chicago says Brendan Gleeson appears in both Gangs and Adam's Countdown choice in Bruges. We also got this one from Max O'Connell in Syracuse, New York. He says Daniel Day-Lewis also played Daniel Plainview in There Will Be Blood, whose voice was inspired by the director of The Treasure of the Sierra Madre, John Huston.
And one of your picks, right?
That was my number one, actually, movie with a place in its title. So we got a lot of those kind of great entries where people did notice all sorts of connections we, of course, didn't count on at all.
And I see you've left it up to me to pronounce Niall O'Brien's name.
Niall is pretty easy, and I even phonetically spelled out where he's writing to us from in Ireland.
Well,
so come on.
Drogheda, Ireland. I mean, I knew that one.
Drogheda.
Oh, crap. Anyways, Niall says, I can't do without my weekly dose of film spotting, and I especially love a good knockdown, drag-out, old-fashioned Josh and Adam Barney.
I love Barney.
Your placid concurrence over Nebraska obviously affected the Massacre Theater performance this week. Mr. Day-Lewis would not approve.
It's true that there wasn't quite enough massacre in our Massacre Theater. We'll see if we can do better this week. If you want to hear that scene, plus our review of Nebraska and our top five movies with a place in their title, you can get that show at filmspotting.net or via iTunes. Josh, reach into the film spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
Our winner is Eli Bard from New York City.
Eli Bard, a longtime listener of the show, and I guess we just need to ask him what gang of New York he is from. He didn't share that in his entry. Congratulations, Eli. Email feedback at filmspotting.net, and we'll set you up with your free six-month subscription to Fandor.com.
Camera, look at camera. Slowly. Passion. Passion. Camera. My
side.
Passion.
And with intensity.
Is that everything? I mean, it seemed like you said quite a bit more than that.
This one is going to be a doozy. Josh, you said you haven't practiced out loud, but you have at least listened to the scene, so...
I've listened to it a few times.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm just hoping this doesn't sound like a leprechaun, because it could go that way. Just know I don't mean for that to happen.
No. Keep that in mind, that he's not supposed to sound like a leprechaun. We are not doing a scene from Leprechaun 7 or... whichever one of those is Josh's favorite. This week's scene does tie in, actually, with our discussion of Old Boy a bit earlier in the show. And Josh, you do have the juicy part, so you're going to kick it off. Are you ready?
This goes on for a little bit. Let me take a breath here.
Yeah, and I actually cut this down pretty significantly, so you don't have such a big monologue here. And action.
When I was in prison, second time, no telling a lie. Third stretch, yeah, third. There was this screw who really had it in for me, and that geezer was top of my list. 2 years after I got sprung, I sees him in Arnold Park. He's sitting on a bench feeding bloody pigeons. There was no one about. I could have been up behind him and snapped his neck. What? But I left it. I could have nobbled him, but I didn't. Because what I thought I want, what I thought I would think about was something else. I didn't give a toss. It didn't matter, see? This buck on the bench won't work my time. It meant sod all in the end, because you got to make a choice. When to do something and when to let it go. When it matters and when it don't. Bide your time. That's what prison teaches you and nothing else. Bide your time and everything becomes clear and you can act accordingly.
There's one thing I don't understand. The thing I don't understand is every mother effing word you're saying. And scene. And never have truer words been spoken.
I have no idea what happened at the end there.
Because what I thought I wanted wasn't what I wanted. I'd like to make you repeat that line just for all of our enjoyment.
I think that one was pretty clear.
Yeah. Well, if you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Monday, December 9th. And we're going back to an old favorite here for Massacre Theater. We are now going to be handing out for our prize a Film Spotting t-shirt.
Back to t-shirts.
We're going back to the t-shirts, but Josh, here's the problem.
Do we have any t-shirts?
No. We do not have any t-shirts.
Well, then let's just give away a car while we're at it.
Good point. You get a car. You get a t-shirt. We are going to get some more t-shirts, so you may have to wait a while, but I'm going to throw it out to Film Spotting Nation. We have a lot of talented people out there. We have the designs already. I think that we're going to keep the designs we have because I really do like them, but we kind of need a new company to work with to print our t-shirts. So if you work for such a company or you have a buddy or some friend who works for one of those types of companies, we'd love to hear from you. Feedback@filmspotting.net. Eventually, you will get your Film Spotting t-shirt.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
You're going to be a good boy and take a dive like Patty said you would. Am I going to have to teach you a lesson?
No, he's good. He's good.
Teach me a lesson?
I gave you a word.
Yeah. Teach you a lesson.
Woody Harrelson, Willem Dafoe, and Casey Affleck there in a scene from Scott Cooper's Out of the Furnace. Scott Cooper, probably best known for his direction of Crazy Heart a few years back with Jeff Bridges. Out of the Furnace is a tale of family loyalty in the Rust Belt. It opens in wide release this weekend, and it did get our attention for featuring not just Harrelson, Affleck and Defoe, but Christian Bale, Forrest Whitaker, and Sam Shepard as well. So with a cast like that, we did smell a death match. And it only now occurs to me after saying all that, that we left out some pretty great actors from this death match, including a guy like Willem Dafoe. But we only have four options for you. The question is simply, only one of these Out of the Furnace stars can continue making movies. You have a tall task here. You get to decide the fates of these actors, whether or not we get to see further contributions from them or not on screen. Who do you choose?
Casey Affleck, Christian Bale, Woody Harrelson, or Forrest Whitaker?
Good stuff.
It's hard for me for two of them, I'll say. It's coming down to two. I could live without Woody Harrelson. I could live without Christian Bale.
Really?
Yeah. Forrest Whitaker or Casey Affleck. Now, Forrest Whitaker almost single-handedly saved Black Nativity, but I don't know if that was enough. I might say Casey Affleck.
Really?
He's the only one who should be allowed to continue to work. I just
really?
Think, yeah, I think there's a lot there that hasn't fully been realized yet, except for the assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford. I thought he was great in that. I don't know. Aren't you like curious about, I mean, we've seen what Christian Bale can do and it's good. Woody Harrelson. Yeah. He's, you know, done some good stuff. I'm not waiting for like this grand performance from him in the future. Forrest Whitaker, possibly. That's why it's hard to pick him.
I just love that you, of course, picked, I'm saying it right now, you picked the two people who are going to finish at the bottom of the poll. Hands down. Casey Affleck, I'm calling it right now.
There's nothing I can do about
Casey Affleck dead last. Not saying he should finish dead last, but he's going to finish dead last. Forrest Whitaker is going to finish just above him.
Let me guess. Christian Bale
is going to win, which is my only disappointment with this poll question. I do have a feeling Christian Bale is going to run away with it or at least get about 36, 37% of the vote. But the correct answer is without a doubt. I feel really strongly about this one. And guess what? Our producer, Sam Van Halgren, is on my side. No hesitation for us, Woody Harrelson.
Well, he hasn't made White Men Can't Jump 2 yet. So that's true. We wouldn't be given that cinematic gem if he was not allowed to act anymore.
I have a deep fondness for White Men Can't Jump.
That's why I said it.
Yes, and I'm not being ironic at all. I really do like that movie. But I think he is great. I think he is one of those actors who elevates the material in every single film he is in. I've never not enjoyed watching Woody Harrelson on screen. He's my guy.
Boy, I'm going to have to do a little research. I bet I could find something that counters that.
Well, it doesn't mean he's always been in great
movies.
He has worked a lot. He's been in some bad films, but I always enjoy watching something that he offers on screen. So Woody Harrelson's my answer. We'll see how it comes out. We'll see if my prognostications pay off or not. We want to know what you think. Vote now at filmspotting.net.
I am 17, and I saw a trailer for Before Midnight, and I thought that looked interesting, having never heard of any of the other befores. So I quickly rented the first two, and I watched all three, binge-watched, if you would, and over the course of 3 days. And I have to tell you that I think those movies are ageless. Like I said, I was 17, and I felt so connected to them because I think they show the relationship we all want to have. It's like the dream of meeting a girl and running away with her. So I think regardless of what age you are, they still have an emotional connection. And I honestly just saw them, since I watched them in such close proximity, as one movie that just had a strong opening act, maybe even stronger middle, and then kind of had a sad ending with the third one, but still all one big great story. Thanks, guys. Keep up the good show.
It's been a while since we've featured a voicemail here from a listener on the show, and unfortunately, we don't know who this listener is. We love it when you tell us who you are and where you're from. That one is anonymous, just a 17-year-old talking about Before Midnight, and I guess, Josh, I thought that with the end of the year creeping up and the fact that Before Midnight, well, I'm just going to say it's going to come up one way or another as we get into some of our end-of-year lists, it occurred to me that maybe we should finally close out our 6 months
There's
long,
a little bit of that left. That
yeah, trilogy
feedback,
of feedback.
Yeah.
So we have been promising that in our bonus content, which you can get if you have the Film Spotting app for iPhone or Windows 8 phone or Android. It's a little bit of bonus audio we bring to you most weeks here on the show, and we will get to some of your feedback on Before Midnight in that bonus content, but we do appreciate our anonymous listener there and his thoughts on the trilogy and how they kind of show the relationship we all want to have. And I like how he said he sees them all as one movie. I think you really can watch them as a set. I think that's something that even came up in our discussion. A couple other notes here real quick before we get to our Korean Auteurs Marathon Awards. We do have, Josh, a wrap party coming up.
We've hinted
at it. We've talked about it a little bit, but we actually had the meeting with Joe and Sam, our producers, and with our stage manager and the guy who coordinates a lot of what goes into that live production, Tyler. So I guess we do actually have to follow through now.
I wasn't going to believe it until we sat in a room and talked about it, and that's now happened.
It has happened. So January 11th, it's Saturday, January 11th, at the Main Stage, great venue here
in
Chicago.
Worked really well last year.
Yeah, I think so. And we had a lot of fun. We thought we could do it even better this year. So it is sort of our blowout. It's where we look back on the year in film and we give you our favorite lead performances and supporting performances and our favorite scenes of the year. Michael Phillips, I believe, I haven't really asked him yet, but I'm guessing Michael Phillips will attend.
He'll be there.
He has to be able to attend. It wouldn't be a big show without him. Tickets go on sale for the Rap Party now. You can get them. Just go to filmspotting.net or mainstage.com. That's M-A-Y-N-E. You'll get all the details there. And it is on a Saturday this year. We had it on a Sunday last January, and hopefully that will bring out a few more of our listeners who maybe are going to travel from other parts of the Midwest, or who knows, we had people last time come from New York and a bunch of other states. So we look forward to seeing some of our out-of-town listeners in addition to our Chicago regulars.
And it also did sell out last year, right? We weren't sure how it was going to go. It did sell out, so maybe don't sit and wait and deciding if you want to come. If you want to come, get the tickets now.
Also wanted to throw out a mention for a fundraising campaign that you can participate in if you so desire. And it's something I will say Film Spotting has contributed to. It's Life Itself, the documentary that is being made by Steve James, the guy, of course, who we know from The Interrupters and Hoop Dreams, among many other films. And he's making a feature-length documentary on the life of Roger Ebert. And you get the title there from Roger Ebert's memoir called Life Itself. And it covers his whole journey, basically. And being that it is Ebert, being that it's Steve James, as I said, who not only is a great documentarian, but someone who I suppose I can call a friend of the show, because he's someone, Josh, who when I reached out to 2 summers ago because I wanted to screen one of his films, Stevie, in my Cinema Verite class at the University of Chicago's Graham School, he came. He gave up a good 2 hours of his night, came for that screening, had a great, great Q&A with my class afterwards, and really gave us some insightful stuff. Was really generous with his time. So I wanted to give some of that generosity back. If you're interested in contributing to that project to help get it made, we'll put a link in the notes for this show at filmspotting.net. That's the actress Lim Soo-jung as the mentally ill protagonist from I'm a Cyborg, But That's Okay, the 2006 film from director Park Chan-wook. She's actually wearing her dead grandmother's dentures and speaking to a vending machine in that very odd but kind of delightful film. It was one of the 6 movies we reviewed in this marathon and was inspired by the film we discussed at the opening of the show, Spike Lee's Old Boy, or actually, of course, the movie that inspired it. It was Park Chan-wook's original Old Boy from 2003. And so, per tradition, we are going to wrap up this marathon with some awards. Hopefully, many of you have followed along through these 6 films. We are going to share a little bit of your feedback here in a moment as well. We're calling these awards the Gwishins. I hope I'm saying that right, or the ghosts. Gwishin is Korean for ghost and refers not to ghosts so much as monsters, but just as people who died. And if you go back and take a look at these 6 films again, they all kind of have that in common. They have these characters, or multiple characters sometimes, haunting other characters in the movie, just like that dead grandmother there in I'm a Cyborg, But That's Okay. Let's go ahead and list off, Josh, the 6 movies we did review in this marathon, just to refresh everyone's memory.
Yeah, we started with Kim Ki-duk's 3-Iron, and then Hong Sang-soo's Woman on the Beach. Then came I'm a Cyborg, But That's Okay, from Park Chan-wook. Next was Na Hong-jin's The Chaser, Lee Chang-dong's Secret Sunshine, and we ended with Kim Ji-woon's A Tale of Two Sisters.
And we did get some feedback on A Tale of Two Sisters, the last movie we reviewed on the show, a movie I didn't review quite as favorably as you, Josh. We got these comments from Nat right here in Chicago.
Just wanted to send a quick note to say that I'm so excited to hear that you're going to be talking about A Tale of Two Sisters, a really excellent film, and yes, definitely a horror movie. It's scary as hell. I don't usually rewatch movies or reread novels, but I've seen A Tale of Two Sisters 4 times, and I'd be glad to watch it again. My ex-girlfriend and I had a habit of getting into angry arguments about almost literally every movie we saw together, but Two Sisters was the one thing we could agree on. Sadly, it was not enough to save that relationship. Terrible title, though, right? The Korean title means Rose Flower Red Lotus, which is the name of an old folktale that the movie is very loosely based on. In Japanese, it's called The Closet. I can see that those titles don't necessarily translate well into English, but I don't know who decided A Tale of Two Sisters would be a good alternative. Speaking of getting lost in translation, the American remake of this movie called The Uninvited is all kinds of terrible.
Yeah, I have not seen The Uninvited. We got this counter response from Joseph Harris in Columbus, Ohio. I saw Two Sisters years ago. Well, really, I got bored and turned it off the first time. Then I forgot about it and accidentally started watching it a second time. I didn't feel tension, just boredom. I was worried that yet again, I was too superficial and I was missing some subtle artistic point.
That was a little more like your reaction, huh?
It was, though. I love how hard Joseph is on himself. He's at least saying, it's probably my fault the movie didn't work, which I'm no stranger to that same approach to some movies that don't work for me. But just a few thoughts there on that last film we reviewed. We'll sprinkle in a few more comments as we get to our actual awards. We have 5 categories. We'll get through this pretty quickly here, but we're going to start with supporting performance. Which one was your favorite of all the 6 films and all the characters we saw? saw.
It comes from I'm a Cyborg, but that's okay, actually, and it's Rain. He plays Ilsun, the resident of the same mental health facility where the main character is at. This is a character who wears handcrafted masks. He's a kleptomaniac. I mean, this could have gone very wrong. It's sort of Rain versus quirkiness, and I think Rain actually wins this one.
Well said.
He's really affecting here. I described him as a soulful pantomime, and I think he does bring something genuinely caring to the demeanor of this character.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. We're probably going to agree on at least the first two categories here. I also chose Rain, Stephen Colbert's nemesis, the pop star. He's just a charismatic presence, and he really is a catalyst for a lot of the action we see unfold on screen. He is this patient who believes he can steal other people's souls, or at least their kind of key attributes. And
sounds horrible, doesn't it?
It does,
when you describe it?
It really does work, and he's someone who develops real fondness and sympathy for that main character, young Goon.
Yeah.
He really keeps her alive. And something about that sympathy he has towards her, that compassion, and the way that plays out really did appeal to me. It also gave me one of my favorite marathon moments. It's not necessarily going to be my favorite, but it's one of them. We'll get to those here in a second. What about lead performance?
I'm sure we're going to agree on this. It's John Do-yeon as Lee Shin-ae in Secret Sunshine. We spent most of our review of that movie talking about her performance. This film, it was a real weepy, and John holds nothing back playing this widow, a recent widow, and a young single mother who encounters even more tragedy when she moves to her late husband's hometown. The wonder here is just the layers and nuance Joan brings to her many scenes of tears, because there are so many of them, but they're almost always for different reasons, and somehow she makes us able to understand those reasons each time.
I can't say it any better than that. She was my choice as well, and as I noted during our discussion, she won Best Actress at Cannes in 2007. Watch the movie. You will understand why. It's really a towering performance. My runner-up, though, I do want to give some love to Kim Yoon-seok, who is the star of The Chaser, which was a fun thriller and kind of a nasty thriller. But that main character, similar in some ways to the lead of Secret Sunshine, though in many ways very different, but someone who is very complex, who there are a lot of layers to. There isn't really an easy black and white way to view that character, but at the same time, the filmmakers don't push his humanity onto us or try to push any kind of grand change. And I thought it's a great performance. So
he's actually in my best moment or scene, which comes from The Chaser. It's the foot chase between him and the serial killer that he's after. I liked how this movie didn't behave like a thriller from Hollywood the way you'd expect it might behave, even though it has a lot of the same elements. And one of these ways is this early foot chase that we talked about. When he's running down the suspect, they pause to catch their breath. That's what you noted in our review. And they also trip. They fall. When they finally catch up to each other, they don't really fight as much as they slip around and they scuffle and then just lay exhausted every once in a while on top of each other. It's just one example of the movie's off-centered use of comedy, but it's also evocative of the picture's own nature in that it darts this way and that where you'd never expect it to go.
Mm-hmm. My favorite moment or scene from the entire marathon goes back to the movie Three Iron, the movie we opened the marathon with, and it's the sequence I spent a lot of time talking about. It's the 180 degrees bit in the jail cell where our main character has been imprisoned and a guard comes in and is looking for him, and even though there's nowhere for him to go, can't seem to find him. It's a nice little visual trick that the character is playing, but also, of course, the director Kim Ki-duk is playing. I argued that that scene is a metaphor for the entire cinematic experience, which I think the whole film might be a large metaphor for that. And that's the sequence where that really jumped out to me. And the camera takes on also at times during that sequence, his point of view, almost as if the camera is becoming that character. And every bit of that jail cell scene really did fascinate me and got me really excited the way best moments from these marathons do. You see something you feel like you haven't seen before. I saw it there in that sequence from Three Iron. We also have another moment we wanted to single out. We tend to do this with our marathons. We notice certain patterns, certain trends, if you will, or just certain stylistic conventions or tropes that appear over and over again, especially if we're talking about the same filmmaker. In this case, we're talking about six different filmmakers, but there was a common element, and what that was, we noted it again and again, was how whatever genre the film seemed to be working in, a movie like A Tale of Two Sisters seems to be a horror film, and The Chaser seems to be a serial killer thriller, there are all these elements introduced that do play with that a little bit. You talked about the comedy of The Chaser. So this is our best genre-bending moment. What did you go with?
It comes from The Chaser, actually, and it's when that main character, the pimp, goes from being this comedic, exasperated small businessman. That's kind of how it's played at the beginning for laughs. He's got employees here. They're prostitutes, but they're his employees who are calling in sick, and he's got other hassles. But then suddenly the movie cuts to the image of one of his prostitutes, played by Seo Young-hee, who actually is sick, and she's really sick. Mm-hmm. We see the effects of this, and we also see that she's the mother, a single mother of a seven-year-old girl. So all of a sudden, real humanity intrudes.
It's kind of domestic drama,
It becomes a domestic drama. The dark laughs are shoved aside a little bit. And key for me was that this was going to be a serial killer thriller in which the people are actually going to matter, which doesn't happen a lot in that genre.
Yeah, I also went with a scene from The Chaser, and I guess I'm just calling it more of the strategy, though there is a moment where everything does culminate, but it's the strategy of catching the killer early. It's not a spoiler, because obviously it's something that happens very early in the film, where you think, based on everything you're seeing happening, that this is going to be a movie where the chase is going to be, are we going to find out who the bad guy is?
Yeah, well,
we
that's find the climax,
out, yeah,
right?
We but find instead, out who the bad guy is. Like 25 minutes or so into the movie, our pimp character who is looking for him runs into him randomly on the street, and they spend a good chunk of the film in the same room. The police are in the same room with him or near him, so the suspense isn't at all about finding the killer or stopping him from killing again. It's really just about getting to the victim in time, and we've seen some of that in other films, but I think even more than that, this becomes a movie about bureaucratic ineptitude and human nature. And you wonder, okay, are we really going to see all of these people fail in their mission when they've got the killer right there in their hands? And the movie has some fun with that question. So that was my genre bending moment. And I did want to share quickly this comment from Scott, who wrote in and said, "The Chaser was just phenomenal. Thanks. I was going to mention some great Korean period dramas, but I'm just too numb after watching this," which I can imagine that reaction to The Chaser. That brings us to our final award. Our final Gwishin or ghost goes to our best picture. What movie did you love the most from the marathon?
I'm going to have to go back to Secret Sunshine. This was a movie that just continued to open up for me as it went along. It begins as this potentially sentimental starting over story that we've seen before. This young mother, single mother, is now going to start a new life in this hometown. Instead of getting better, though, for her, it burrows full bore into tragedy and the ravaging effects of grief. And then we're in the midst of that. It develops into something else, too, this consideration of religion as a means of healing, especially Christianity and its central tenet of forgiveness, and how that can be both a helpful and a dangerous and abused thing. So that's a whole nother level. And the amazing thing about Secret Sunshine is that it holds all of these together so that they don't feel like detours or sidetracks. They really are all centered, and this goes back to the lead performance by Jeon Do-yeon. They're centered on her character and her performance so that we don't see them as these digressions. It's just a rich, rich film and easily the best experience for me from the marathon.
It's one I didn't really consider for my Best Picture award, mainly because I didn't have the same experience watching it you did, or the same experience watching it that I did reviewing it. I think I reviewed a better movie that I felt like I was experiencing in the moment. And that happens sometimes, at least it does for me. I guess what I'm trying to articulate is it's a movie that gets better the more I think about it. And I think that does reflect ultimately the mark of a good film. But for me, my favorite film, the one I would most encourage people to give a try, is the movie we started with. It's Three Iron for me, this odd love story about the relationship between a drifter who just finds his way into people's homes, breaks in and sets up shop and plays out these domestic situations. And he meets a woman who is badly abused by her husband physically and emotionally. And they do embark on this relationship where she kind of becomes his accomplice. It's a very visual film. There's a lack of dialogue that at times made me feel almost like I was watching a silent film. And I never felt like I was missing anything because of that lack of dialogue. As I said when we talked about our favorite moments, it's for me an openly reflexive movie about the voyeuristic nature of watching characters on screen. And for me, it's just the most mysterious and open-hearted of all the films we watch. It's the one I most want to go back to and revisit.
Mysterious is a good word. That's also the one I would watch again. Yeah.
Peter Cho, listener, wrote in and said, "Please see more Kim Ki-duk films. He is weird and perverted, but also a genius storyteller and philosopher. Yes, almost all of his films have horrific scenes, but they are all part of the natural and human storyline. I recommend Spring, Summer, Autumn, Winter, and Spring, and Pieta for your next experience. His films are happy, sad, terrible, and wonderful, just like life." I don't know how you say it much better than that. Happy, sad, terrible, and wonderful. Pieta is his most recent film. It's one neither of us have had a chance to catch up with yet. And I do want to mention in closing one other email we got about Three Iron. Paul Stafford in London wrote in with some really nice comments and an interesting read on the film. And I'm actually going to post the email in the Film Spotting forum. And there'll be a link to that in the show notes for this show, 471, over at filmspotting.net, if you want to read what Peter has to say. But he comments on Three Iron as a critique on the shortcomings of a society that selectively ignores some of its own flaws. And he gets into some interesting things, but he says, you see, Tae-suk, the main character, does not merely represent truth. He is truth. And to the societal eyes that do not see, he is invisible. Despite his imprisonment, the guards over time lose sight of him. Note the all-seeing eye painted on his hand as he practices Tai Chi, which prefaces his seeming disappearance to the guards. This critique may not be leveled at society in general, but more a lament for the inaction of those in power who preside over an opportunity to make positive changes, yet never wield that power.
Yeah, I think he's onto something.
Yeah, I think he's onto something too. It's something I didn't really consider at all as I watched the movie, but again, mysterious and a movie that I think encourages varying interpretations. So thank you, Paul, and everyone else who wrote in and who followed along. We hope it was fun for you. I definitely feel like we crossed off some major films and filmmakers we needed to cross off our list, Josh, and we'll get back to our marathons. We're going to take a little break now as we get into the end of year stuff, but coming in January, February, we do have three marathons planned. Actually, speaking of links in our show notes, I'll link to our current plan for those three marathons. We've already decided them for the next year. So
do we know which one we're going to do just next?
I think we do, but as with all things on the show, it's open for discussion. We can be convinced one way or another. We could be convinced that our three ideas are terrible if
are
you want.
Are we leaning toward Elaine May? Was that
Elaine May, I think, was going to be first. I think maybe just a four-film marathon from Elaine May, but that was our plan. Cassavetes also in the mix, I think. And one other one I know, but I'm just going to make it mysterious. I'm going to make you go click on the link and go over to Letterboxd and see the list of films we're planning on discussing. Again, that'll be in the show notes at filmspotting.net.
All right, it's the moment Hollywood agents have been breathlessly awaiting. Coming up, we name our 2013 discoveries, those new faces in front and behind the camera who wowed us this year. Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us.
Years ago, my heart was set to live. Oh, and I've been trying hard against unbelievable odds. It's so hard in times like now to hold on. But guns that wait to be stuck by at my side is God. And there ain't no one going to turn me. Tell you that they know the places where to send you, and it's easy to go. They'll sip you up and dress you down and stand you in a row, but you know you don't have to. You could just say no. And there ain't no one going to turn me.
Donation time here on the show, where we thank some of our listeners who sent us some of their hard-earned dollars in support of the show. We really do appreciate everything you contribute. And I feel bad, Josh, because it's been building up in our P.O. box over the past couple of weeks. We have had some listeners who have decided to forego the PayPal route and instead actually send us a letter in the mail.
It's really the only safe way to do it.
That's true. So we got a check, or in some cases, we got some cash. Cold hard cash.
That's not very safe.
Which, yeah, I don't think that really does make sense for the post office. But you know what? We got it. Everything came through. And we do appreciate every bit that we get. So we're going to get to some of those emails and some of those letters. And we start with a letter. This is a note that came to us from a platinum level donor. That is the biggest we can get. We thank you so much, Sandy.
And thank you, Sandy, for writing your note on a gold star.
Yeah.
A paper gold star. Has that ever happened before?
No.
I didn't think so. Adam, Josh, and team, a very belated donation that falls somewhere between a buck a show and $5 a month since I found your podcast in the latter part of 2010. Love hearing your show every week and visiting your forum daily. It's the greatest.
Maybe Sandy contributed more than Sandy intended to, because
that
I feel
math
like there was a lot
out.
More than what that math just suggested. But either way, We'll take the donation.
Don't say anything.
We'll take the kind words. Thank you, Sandy. We also got a gold level donation from Frederick in Copenhagen, Denmark, and from Jim in Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
Longtime listener, first time contributor. I often mention your reviews and recommendations to my wife, Lynn, and I occasionally listen when she's within earshot, but I had no idea she even knew about donating. So imagine my surprise when a couple of weeks ago, after Lynn and I saw Gravity and we were discussing the film, I mentioned the film Spotting Take when she says you really should send them a donation. I'm nothing if not an obedient spouse, so it's a pleasure to send you my first donation. If Lynn has anything to do with it, it's not likely to be my last.
Well, Jim, I'm going to confess here, is a former colleague of mine. I knew him back as a young know-nothing, my first job out of college, and he was always great to me, and it really was a treat for me to discover that he became a pretty devoted film spotting listener, and obviously still is. He's a good guy. Lynn sounds like she might be even better. So thank you, Lynn, for encouraging your husband's donation. We do appreciate it, and hope everyone is doing well back there in Cedar Rapids. We also got another gold-level donation this week from Randolph in Richmond, Virginia, and he sent us this letter.
It's definitely time to pay the dealer. I enjoyed your top five movie themes, was surprised that the music from The Sting was not somebody's honorable mention. Keep up the great work. P.S. Can't wait to hear my name on the air.
Well, Randolph from Richmond, Virginia, you heard it, and you heard it twice. Thank you so much. We also got a $5 a month donation from Right on Target Marketing, and that's how we're going to say it. I don't know
All
if
right.
there's a name attached to it or not, but, you know, we're just like Mitt Romney. We believe that corporations are people.
That's right.
Their money is just as good as anybody else's. We also got a new $5 a month subscription from Chris Moody in Tetbury, England, and he has been a longtime listener and a longtime writer into the show, for lack of a better phrase. He sends us a lot of great feedback, and he sends us these comments.
Hi, Adam, Josh, Sam, and whichever interns haven't been fired yet. We don't fire interns during the holiday season, right?
No.
No.
No. After.
Having only donated once in nearly 7 years, this is long overdue. I often write a yay-us note of Thanksgiving at this time of year that hopefully gives you an emotional reward for enriching my cinematic world. But hopefully this new monthly subscription will be some kind of actual reward. I started listening with the traumatic episode number 138, where Adam practically broke down trying to describe the amazing one-timer Grave of the Fireflies. My younger daughter was just over a year old at that point, so I gave the film a miss for a few years until I plucked up courage to watch it. Ouch. So apart from making me cry like a baby at the first film I heard you recommend, Why Do I Love Film Spotting? Since then, I've lost count of the films I wouldn't have seen if it weren't for Film Spotting. In recent months, this would include the wonderful Before Sunrise, Sunset, Midnight trilogy, which we watched on consecutive nights, so slightly compressed from their original 9 years apart creation.
Yeah, just slightly compressed. Chris closes by saying, I've recommended and blogged about Film Spotting for anyone who will listen. Indeed, my humble blog, What I Reckon, has had more traffic to these two posts that I wrote about Film Spotting than pretty much anything else. So I give thanks not only to you guys for Film Spotting, but to the amazing Film Spotting audience who have visited my blog and helped keep me doing what I do there. It's very much a hobby I fit in when I can, but there are plenty of film reviews, and I will be adding my thoughts on the Before trilogy when I get a spare couple of hours. So again, thank you, Chris, for the donation, for the Yay Us emails over the years, and also the emails where you're telling us how much we got something wrong. We appreciate those just as much, and we will link to your blog in the show notes. We also got a Buck a Show donation, and how perfect for this show, Josh, where we are finally closing out our Korean O'Tours Marathon, from Arthur in Incheon, South Korea. I think our first ever South Korean donation. I could be wrong, but that is a first as far as I can recall. We also got a Silver Club donation from a listener identifying herself simply as Albuquerque film fan. And this is another one that came in with a two-page typed letter and some really nice comments and some really interesting thoughts about movies in general. I'm just going to read Albuquerque film fans' closing comments here. Thank you for listening to my esoteric rant, and thank you for your wonderful podcast and iPhone app. I'm enclosing a check, which is the money I did not spend on the following movies currently showing in my local theaters: Ender's Game, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs 2, and Carrie. I will, however, endeavor to see 12 Years a Slave and Gravity. I'm not embarrassed to admit that I saw the movie The Fifth Estate and liked it. I also saw Rush and was sad to see that Ron Howard has forgotten how to develop characters in his films.
Wow. I wonder if Albuquerque film fan knows Right on Target Marketing.
I wonder. We can make a connection there, but thank you so much for that donation. And that brings us to another Silver Club donation from Ben Rain in Eugene, Oregon, or Do you want to take it, Josh?
Oregon?
Oregon.
Oregon.
Yeah.
Whichever way you want to go. Thanks for the show, Adam and Josh. A few musings as I gratefully send in a donation. I teach a high school intro to film class here in Eugene, and my own personal pantheon, plus the curriculum for my class, includes film spotting faves Rear Window and The Apartment, among several others. Josh, I wonder if your appreciation of Wes Anderson's signature look and style is inspired by Hitchcock's dollhouse use of apartment windows in Rear Window. Never thought about
Intriguing.
That. I like it. Adam, I mentioned The Apartment because its particular combination of societal commentary and emotional involvement reminds me of what I consistently value about your reviews. By the way, you are right about Hugo.
Thank you.
And, well, it may be time for you to join the Hunger Games bandwagon, or at least give it a try. Keep up the great work, you two.
Well, I am definitely going to catch up with the latest installment in the Hunger Games franchise. I am.
You are.
I'm actually excited about it. I just
Good,
haven't
you
had
should be.
Time yet, and, you know, societal commentary and emotional involvement in my reviews. I mean,
that's
I mean,
just
Josh,
all over.
You really are not appreciating me enough here.
Apparently.
For what I bring to the show. Thank you so much for that. And we close out donations, our favorite segment of the show, with a final mention of another donor, Matthew in Washington, D.C. Thank you, Matthew, and everyone who donated. Again, if you want to support the show but just are not ready to donate, you can go to iTunes, give us a 5-star rating, and write some nice comments about the show. You can also, of course, patronize our sponsors. You don't even necessarily have to buy anything. Just maybe check them out. That's fine, too. Shutterstock.com, Audible, Squarespace, whatever it might be that we're pushing that week. We do appreciate every bit of support we get. It does help keep us doing what we're doing. Built up and trusted.
Broke down and busted. Hello there, listeners over at the Film Spotting Mothership. This is Allison Wilmore from FilmSpotting's streaming video unit, where in our latest episode, Matt Singer and I debate whether the age of 27 is indeed old, as we talk about Noah Baumbach and Greta Gerwig's Frances Ha.
And since it's getting to be that top 10 list-making time of year, we'll also be offering a few more recommendations from 2013 available for instant streaming or rental. To listen or subscribe to the show, you can find us in iTunes or at FilmSpottingSVU.com.
This is Craig Brewer, the director of Black Snake Moan, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
I'm a competitive racer, Div. I don't think you need to school me on the importance of getting there first. Thank you.
All right. That was your father's lawyer?
This is in-house counsel. He's going to look at all this, and if he thinks it's appropriate, he'll send a cease and desist letter.
What's that going to do?
What, do you want to hire an IP lawyer and sue him?
No, I want to hire the Sopranos to beat the out of him with a hammer.
We don't even have to do that. That's right. We can do that ourselves. I'm 6'5", 220, and there's two of me.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Josh and Adam, and that has to be one of the best, most memorable lines from a film that is filled with great and memorable lines. That is Armie Hammer from The Social Network, David Fincher's 2010 film. Armie Hammer was Josh Larson's number one up-and-coming actor back in April 2012.
I'm starting to worry that there's a Film Spotting discovery curse.
Yeah, maybe so.
We talked about Elizabeth Olsen going from Martha, Marcy May Marlene to Old Boy. Armie
right.
Hammer went from Social Network to The Lone Ranger.
I'll always be able to look back to the 2008 version of that list where I did have as my number one Channing Tatum.
Oh.
I called it. I called Channing Tatum's career. So
that was good. That was good.
The agents do need to listen to the show, though they should just ignore my 2 through 5 picks from that year. I'm good for at least one. We'll see how we do as we get to our top 5 film spotting discoveries. We've often saved this category for kind of our blowout or our end of year discussion. But as we are embarking on that time of year where you're going to start hearing our picks for best films of the year, and as we get to things like best actor and best actress, we thought it would make a good top 5 category to actually launch all that year-end stuff. Look back on the year, take stock of films we saw in 2013 that are 2013 films, where we saw people, actresses, actors, or maybe it was a director. It could be subject matter, whatever it might be, that we discovered for the first time. Maybe the world didn't discover them, but we discovered them through a 2013 movie. So again, not necessarily new, but new to us in 2013. What's your number 5, or who is your number 5?
New to me was Rin Takahashi, star of Like Someone in Love. This was Abbas Kiarostami's film, Tokyo Set. She plays a high-end prostitute named Akiko. And we see three sides of her in this film, the professional call girl part, but also this beleaguered girlfriend. She has sort of a harassing boyfriend in the movie. And she's a lost granddaughter, too. We hear on her phone these messages from her grandmother, who's in Tokyo and wants to connect with her. The movie's signature shot, at least for me, was this long take of Akiko sitting in a cab while she's listening to these voicemails, actually. And they just get increasingly sad as you can sense the grandmother getting the idea that they're not going to meet. And just while she sits there, all of these troubles going on in her life play across Takanashi's face. It's a really an amazing scene. Takanashi mostly worked in Japanese television before Like Someone in Love. And I saw that she has added a few Japanese film credits in the last year or so. Unfortunately, I haven't seen them, so this is all I have to go on for now.
Yeah, it's a great scene and a great performance. I'm glad to see her make your list. For me, the only thing I really considered is not just rewarding those performances that were new to me and stood out, but also thinking about it in terms of how excited am I to see what comes next from these people, whether, again, they're an actor or an actress or a filmmaker. The one exception to that rule for me is my number five pick, because we won't be hearing from any of these people again, unfortunately, and it is going to be a crushing blow to any music street cred I had built up over the years here on the show, if I had built up any music street cred. It's actually the band Big Star, the band responsible for the music we've been featuring here in the breaks of this show. They are the subject of the 2013 documentary Big Star, Nothing Can Hurt Me. And I'd heard of the band. I knew the frontman, Alex Chilton, thanks to the replacement song, Alex Chilton. I was vaguely familiar with the fact that that 70s show, their theme song, was Cheap Trick doing a Big Star tune. But that was the extent of my knowledge of the band. I otherwise did not know any of their music, could never have picked a song and named it as a Big Star song. They're a band that was formed in the early 70s in Memphis, and their first album came out. It was called Number One Record. It's an album that was critically adored, still critically adored, but just never connected with mainstream America, and none of their albums subsequently did. The documentary chronicles that struggle with success and their internal problems that did ultimately derail the band, and the movie spends a fair amount of time covering how influential they were. Not only the Replacements were a band that drew a lot of inspiration from them, but REM, Elliott Smith, the Flaming Lips, these are all groups that kind of came out of a Big Star sensibility. And I know a lot of musicians and critics hold Big Star in high regard. After seeing the movie and hearing some of their songs, I understand why. Number One Record is now a go-to album for me when I'm looking for something catchy to listen to. Hopefully some people heard those songs for the first time here on the show and want to give them a listen. So Big Star is my number five discovery.
My number four is someone I actually did see before, but in a very small part, Miles Teller from The Spectacular. Now, he was in 2010's Rabbit Hole from John Cameron Mitchell, but I didn't even make that connection while I was watching The Spectacular. Now, others did become aware of him from the Footloose remake from 2011, but I never saw that. So he was fresh for me. My first sense of what he could do was in The Spectacular Now, and it's really a bittersweet part he has here. He captures this high school charmer who's appealing glow has begun to dim a little bit the closer graduation comes. He's this party guy who doesn't have much more to offer, and his classmates are starting to realize that as they're thinking about moving on.
What about like ex-boyfriends? Say, we need an ex-boyfriend in there.
No, I don't have
Who's like an ex-boyfriend that just like really pissed you off, that you just that just like you hated? And if they're just like,
I don't have an ex-boyfriend.
What?
Yeah.
You don't have a single, you're 17 years old, you don't have an ex-boyfriend?
No.
Really?
Sutter, guys don't look at me like that.
That's shocking. Yeah, absolutely, guys look at you like
no,
that.
No, no,
I just saw two guys looking at you like that. Eric Wolf and Cody Dennis
were
100% hitting on you.
No, we were just talking. They were 100%. Not hitting on me. No, no, there's absolutely
yes,
no way.
Why don't you think they were hitting on you?
Because I'm just, they weren't.
Because you're what? Amy, you're absolutely beautiful.
Oh my God, no.
Teller needs movie star charisma for this part, and he certainly has that right away, but he also needs something more rare, which is this ability to give us a sense of the character's fears and insecurities, kind of get at that deeper level, and he certainly has that in the film. Teller's star is on the rise. He and Spectacular Now co-star Shailene Woodley are both going to be in the next YA sci-fi blockbuster to be. It's next year's Divergent.
Yeah, I'm glad that you discovered Miles Teller. He's great in Spectacular Now, and he's someone I have been promoting here on the show ever since Rabbit Hole, and also Footloose, which you don't ever need to see. It's really just a bad, bad remake, even though I like Craig Brewer, the director, quite a bit. But Teller is really good, maybe the only good thing about that film for me. My number four discovery is the 20-year-old French actress Lola Creton. She is the star or co-star of the movie from Olivier Assayas, Something in the Air, or its original French title is Après May, After May. Her breakout was the 2009 Catherine Breillat film Bluebeard, but has only been in five or six movies, I think, up to this point. I had never seen her before until I saw her as Christine in Something in the Air. She's a character who our young protagonist meets and falls in love with while traveling in Europe. These are 18, 19-year-old kids who get out of high school at the height of the revolutionary spirit in France right after the riots of 1968. And they want to go out in search of whatever they can find, the revolution, art, figuring out their roles in whatever revolution may be out there, and specifically how they may be able to use art to influence that and reflect it. She has a really striking face, and here she's a teenager playing a teenager, but she's sort of a chameleon too. She at times looks far younger than her years, almost like she's not mature enough for some of the things her character is facing. But then in some later scenes, and as she gets a little bit older, you can see her and feel like she's far, far older than the character she's playing. And it really is just in subtle adjustments she makes as an actress. Before Something in the Air, she made a movie called Goodbye First Love, which I didn't see until after Something in the Air. And it was on Netflix Instant. I didn't have a chance to look it up and see it, if it is still there. But a good film, definitely worth seeking out, that really focuses more on Cretan. It's her story. She's out now in Claire Denis' latest film, Bastards, which is one hopefully we will see at some point here as we get through our slog of end-of-year viewing. But that's Lola Cretan. She is my number four discovery.
Yeah, and I'm going to have to see Something in the Air, actually. I have a feeling it might be on a few more of your lists as we get close to the end here.
Maybe.
My number three is Lupita Nyong'o from 12 Years a Slave. There's probably no point in saying which of the slave characters in Steve McQueen's historical drama had it the worst, but surely Lupita Nyong'o's character, Patsy, she suffered in a particularly terrible way. She was the favored slave of Michael Fassbender's deranged plantation owner, Epps, and what this meant is she's repeatedly raped and becomes a pawn in the cruel games between Epps and his wife.
I went to Master Shaw's plantation.
You admit it?
Yes, freely. And you know why? I got this from Mrs. Shaw. Mrs. Epps won't even grant me no soap to clean with. I stink so much I make myself gag.
Your heart falters a lot during 12 Years a Slave, but Nyong'o stops it dead with Patsy's midnight plea to Solomon Northup. That's the main figure played by Chiwetel Ejiofor. I'll spare the details of what that involves, but it was an essential scene for me in this film, and it has a lot to do with what Nyong'o brings to it. She was raised in Kenya, but graduated from the Yale School of Drama, and next up, all I saw was a small part in a Liam Neeson action movie. The gray aside, I hope there's more for her in the future than that sort of stuff.
Yeah, this is a list, I have to confess, I formed before finally seeing 12 Years a Slave. I did see it. I decided to stick with my top five as it is, but I definitely would have strongly considered her for this top five. It's an astonishing performance. And I think there's probably a tendency among critics and viewers to reward characters who suffer on screen, but it's much more than that.
Oh, yeah.
It's not just those big emotional scenes or the traumatic scenes. It's every other moment. And the way she's able to embody that character to a degree where I almost felt like I wasn't watching an actress anymore. I really felt that facade go away in every aspect of that performance.
No, I'm glad you said that, because it isn't just that scene. It's how she has built up to it in every other moment she's appeared. So, yeah, it's really a full performance.
My number three discovery is actually Olivia Wilde from the Joe Swanberg movie Drinking Buddies. And I know some people are thinking, wait a second, Olivia Wilde, she's been in like 20 movies over the past 5 years. How can you call her a discovery? The fact is, I was looking at her IMDb page, Josh, and it confirmed for me what I thought, which is I had never seen a movie with Olivia Wilde in it before. She was in Year One, The Next 3 Days, Tron Legacy, Cowboys and Aliens, In Time. Nope, I didn't see any of those films. Now, I did know her, obviously, by name and face, but I've never seen one of those films. And this film, Drinking Buddies, one of my Golden Brick contenders, is a Swanberg film about friends and coworkers played by my guy Jake Johnson and Olivia Wilde. They work together at a craft brewery here in Chicago. And they're friends who probably should be lovers, and that's the tension that really drives the entire movie. She's not just really good. I think she's great in this movie. Her intelligence comes through. She plays someone who is full of layers and full of contradictions. She seems extroverted and an open book at times, but also sense that she's always hiding something, always protecting herself. The acting and the dialogue in some of these sequences, especially with Johnson and Wilde, is so good and seems so natural that it's easy to watch it and think that maybe Swanberg took a Mike Lee kind of approach where they improvised the scenes, rehearsed it, and then patterned a script out of that. And so they were crafting something that feels improvisational. It turns out, I found out later, this really mostly was improvised. And what comes through most in that dialogue is an authenticity and a vulnerability, especially in that wild character, that makes everything about the movie ring really true.
I was full of yesterday. I don't know. Ugh, whatever.
Hey, here's the truth. I'm done giving you and I'm sorry. I have no place. You are a grown woman. And if you want to have sex with a disgusting bad brewer with a terrible attitude.
I don't love Dave.
You smell good.
Really?
Yeah. Surprised you got all Dave off of you.
Maybe you're smelling Dave.
And after seeing the film and after liking her performance quite a bit, I did catch up with her interview with Elvis Mitchell on The Treatment. If you go back, if you're curious at all, seek that out. I think a lot of what I've said about her and this performance will be validated just in how insightful she was in that interview. And it's a great listen. We'll link to it in the show notes over at filmspotting.net.
I don't know. I can't believe you didn't at some point have a double feature at home of Cowboys and Aliens and Tron Legacy.
I know.
It just seems like your kind of night.
After all these years, Josh, 2 years, you still don't know me.
All right, number two, the director of Fruitvale Station, Ryan Coogler. This was the drama based on the last day in the life of Oscar Grant, who was shot and killed in 2009 by transit police in Oakland. And there are two reasons why this was much better than the sort of indignant docudrama that I feared. One was Michael B. Jordan's really remarkably nuanced portrayal as Oscar Grant, but also Coogler's directorial vision, especially for a first-timer, or at least a first-time feature director. He decided to put the person before the cause here, or at least before the issue or the incident. And what that does is it roots the movie in the complicated humanity of Oscar Grant. So we get both his flaws, we get the sense of nobility to him. We never lose sight of him, I think, is the important thing, as this real person. And that makes us fully feel his murder as the tragic loss that it was. Next up for Coogler is the Rocky spinoff, Creed. And you know, Adam, I do consider the Rocky franchise just the pinnacle of American cinema. So I'm really excited about
well,
that.
How do they possibly top Rocky Balboa?
It's going to be tough.
Yeah, it is. And Michael B. Jordan, the star of Fruitvale Station, is playing Creed. And that will be one reason to see the film. It would be the biggest reason to see it for me, besides my actual love for a lot of those Rocky films, because safe to say, after finally catching up with Fruitvale Station, for now, I will just impart that I did not have the same reaction to the director's work as you did.
I saw that on Letterboxd. Deeply disappointing.
Yeah, I think a lot of what you said actually rings true. I like all of your reasons. I think they're valid for why you like the film, except for the part where you praise the direction and ultimately praise the movie. I'm just not there on Fruitvale Station, but I am sort of being aloof because I know that when we get to our end of the year show and our top 10 films of the year, whether it makes your top 10 or not, I'm pretty sure it's going to make Michael Phillips' top 10. Spoiler alert.
He really went for it.
We're going to talk about Fruitvale Station again at some point down the road. That brings us to my number two discovery, and I'm going with Destin Cretton. No, not Destin Cretton. I can't have two of those on my list. I believe it's Destin Cretton. He is the writer-director of the film Short Term 12, a movie we reviewed a month or two ago about a foster care facility. Brie Larson plays Grace, and her boyfriend Mason, played by John Gallagher, works there as well. They're trying to help people, basically, who are as broken as they are, or at least as broken as she is, and it gets in really to the difficulty of that. I wouldn't call Short Term 12 a tough watch because I think there are enough moments of levity and enough moments of, yes, Grace, like the character's name implies. I discussed during our review how I love the way Cretton plays with different forms of expression. You see a lot of characters employ different artistic means to say something, to finally articulate something, whether it's a problem they're having or just finally being totally honest with themselves or another character. And that reflexivity, I wonder if that's maybe a Destin Cretton trend, if that's something we're going to see in a lot of his work, because I was reading again about his 2012 feature debut called I Am Not a Hipster. It's a movie I haven't seen, but I know it's about the San Diego art scene and the indie music scene there. So there seems to be some reflexivity to it. And that may translate well to his next work. He's actually in pre-production on a film called The Glass Castle. It's based on the Jeanette Walls memoir, and the main character is the voice writing the story, the Jeanette Walls character. Jennifer Lawrence, I believe, is set to star in that movie. So again, sort of playing with form a little bit and how we express ourselves, especially how we express ourselves when we're dealing with personal trauma and personal tragedy. So I think he's got a very bright future, and I probably would have wanted to see The Glass Castle anyway. I want to see it even more now that I know that the director of Short Term 12 is the guy behind it.
Yeah, I didn't like Short Term 12 quite as much as you did, but I definitely agree Cretton is a promising director to watch. All right, our number ones, and mine is Adele Exarchopoulos from Blue is the Warmest Color. She was the reason this movie worked for me. I mean, whenever things got too meta or too voyeuristic or just plain aloof, there's a little bit of that there. Exarchopoulos brought it back to being this really precise portrait of a 17-year-old girl who's hurtling her way into adulthood. We talked about how the camera never leaves her face, yet never for an instant do you sense that she's aware of it. This reminded me of what I mentioned in our To the Wonder review, how Terrence Malick actors, the one thing they need is that ability to have a camera in their face and not be aware of it. She certainly has that. I also think this is a performance that relies on naivete a little bit. And Exarchopoulos has a handful of previous credits before Blue is the Warmest Color, but still, it reminded me of a child actor's performance here a little bit, similar to Kuvanjine Wallace's from Beasts of the Southern Wild last year, where there's just this naivete to the process, whether she's managing to put that on us or whether it's genuine, it certainly works for the film. So because she has that, it's hard to say where she's going to go next, but the instinct is definitely there.
Et puis aussi son exigence dans l'engagement. J'adhère complètement.
Ouais, c'est un peu comme Bob Marley, quoi.
Ouais.
Presque.
Je sais pas, je suis pas sûre.
Ouais, je suis presque sûre. Bah, les idées, elles se rejoignent un peu. Tu vois, elles sont get up, stand up.
Bah ouais, je vois.
Bah, je trouve qu'il est engagé.
Ouais, c'est vrai.
C'est pareil que Sartre. C'est un peu un philosophe, c'est un prophète, c'est la même chose.
Yeah, Exarchopoulos, which is just fun to say, is an honorable mention for me. My number one discovery is going to help me now lose any film cred I've developed in addition to having already lost my music cred.
It's pretty worthless at the end of this show.
Admission that I had never really heard of Big Star or heard any of their music before this year. I'm not sure before this year I had ever even heard the name Johnny Toe, much less seen one of his movies, but because of many discerning critics and cinephiles I follow on Twitter and also on Letterboxd, his name kept popping up. He's only, Josh, a filmmaker who's made something like 30-plus feature films as a writer, director, and also a producer in Hong Kong going back to the mid-80s. He has a huge fan in Quentin Tarantino. I think that's how he got on the radar of a lot of American film fans. He's known for his gangster movies, his crime movies like Breaking News and Triad Election and Exiled. And I caught up with Drug War one night on iTunes. Never a great thing when you're watching a film on your laptop, necessarily. But I was in a hotel room. I was on the road, and I was watching it late at night. I'd had a big dinner. I'd had a couple of drinks. I was really prepared to kind of go into a coma watching this movie, especially because it runs right around 2 hours. But it hums along. This movie cooks along, and it really was one of my favorite movies of the year so far. I'm not sure it's going to crack my top 10, but it's really up there. And of course, I do want to see more Johnny Toe films now to see how Drug War stacks up. Sean Gilman, our dean of the Film Spotting Forum, he's one of those discerning listeners. He loves Johnny Toe. He says it's a major Johnny Toe film, perhaps his most epic in scope. Also, it is Toe's Tarantino film, structured as a series of conversations with one of the parties pretending to be someone else, with a buildup and diffusion of tension until a final burst of ultraviolence. I think Sean says it really well. The story is pretty simple. It's about a police captain who's out to bring down a drug ring and all the steps and all the layers that he goes through to make that happen. And it is a film that really does just rely on the action. It's a movie, actually, that was surprisingly a great double feature with the movie I saw the very next day, a movie we haven't had a chance to discuss at all on the show. It's the Robert Redford vehicle, All Is Lost, by J.C. Chander, which I never would have considered All Is Lost a movie about a guy who's alone at sea and trying to survive, and this movie Drug War is being anything similar, but they are both driven by the action. They're about characters who are just moving on to the next task, to the next crisis. There's no time for explanations, no time for exposition or backstories or motivations. The audience has to be willing to just go along for the ride and put some of those pieces together on their own and fill in those spaces and choose to draw any larger meaning from it if you want to, or you can just cut up in an intense survival movie, in the case of All Is Lost, which I do recommend people seek out, or this film, an intense cat and mouse kind of thriller. So Johnny Toe, for me, big, big discovery. And just today, I'm trying to remember who it was. I'm drawing a blank. It was on Twitter. One of our followers said, "How about a Johnny Toe marathon?" And he's definitely one of those filmmakers that I think could make that list maybe down the road. If not for 2014, maybe beyond.
Well, you've now seen one more Johnny Toe movie than I have, so you've got that going for
you. Now cred reestablished, hopefully. Those are our top five 2013 discoveries. Josh, what about any honorable mentions?
Well, I talked about Michael B. Jordan from Fruitvale Station. Another person I considered, Elizabeth Debicki from The Great Gatsby. Really nice supporting turn there. The director of The Spectacular Now deserves a mention, too. That would be James Ponsoldt. And also the director of one of my favorite documentaries from this year, The Act of Killing. One more, Goro Miyazaki, Hayao Miyazaki's son, who made From Up on Poppy Hill. That was the second feature film of his, actually, but the first I've seen, and I was really impressed.
Well, we had a lot of overlap there. I also had Elizabeth Debicki from The Great Gatsby. I had Oppenheimer from The Act of Killing, James Ponsoldt from The Spectacular Now, and, as I mentioned, Exarchopoulos, but also the director, Abdelatif Kashish from Blue is the Warmest Color, a name that was completely off my radar. Curious to see what comes next from him. I'd also mention Lake Bell, the writer, director, and star of In a World, and Death, the band from the documentary A Band Called Death, to go with my big star pick, a band that really was at the forefront of sort of punk and soul music in the 70s, I believe it was. It's been a while since I've seen it, in Detroit, and is a band that has just now kind of been discovered and embraced by many listeners and critics. We'd love to know what your 2013 discoveries were. Send us your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter at filmspotting and at facebook.com/filmspotting.
Out in limited release, opening here in Chicago this weekend, I Am Divine, a documentary about John Waters' regular Harris Glenn Milstead, a.k.a. Divine. Also, Is the Man Who Is Tall Happy?, an animated conversation with Noam Chomsky. It is a documentary that is exactly what it sounds like, but directed by Michelle Gondry. There's also The Punk Singer, a documentary about Bikini Kill singer and Riot Girl pioneer Kathleen Hanna. Out in wide release, Out of the Furnace, starring Christian Bale, Woody Harrelson, Casey Affleck, and Forest Whitaker. And with a cast like that, including Willem Dafoe and Sam Shepard, it doesn't really matter what that film's about. We're going to see it, and we're going to review it next week.
That should be a cast of a Jeff Nichols film, actually.
I like
it. Doesn't it seem like it?
Let's make it happen someday. I'm all in on that. It is directed by Crazy Heart Scott Cooper. So we'll talk about Out of the Furnace, and we will get to our Golden Brick finalists. A couple weeks ago, you heard the movies that were on our short list for that coveted Film Spotting Award, our overlooked movie of the year. We're going to share those final five or six picks next week on the show.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Hogren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. Our featured music came from Big Star. More information about the Big Star documentary, Big Star Nothing Can Hurt Me, is at bigstarstory.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.